2017 in the Capitol. What a year it was. The state budget was late, the long-term transportation funding not resolved, and there was a package of incentives for Foxconn. So it's a great time for a year-in-review interview with Assembly Democratic Leader Gordon Hintz. Thank you, and happy holidays to your family, daughter, and spouse.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you as well.
1 year from now, when we're doing this, what's going to be the makeup of the next session? How many R's, how many D's in the Assembly, and why?
Well, I'm not going to throw numbers around, but I believe there will be more D's. I think there'll be dramatic change that sends a message to this state that's reflective of the fact that people don't support the direction that we've taken under Governor Walker the last 8 years. I do believe there'll be a Democratic governor, and I think we'll finally move forward to address so many of the things that we have punted on over the last 8 years.
There's a Democratic governor. What's top two items on your list when you go see she or he, the Democratic governor, the incoming?
Well, my first thing is just to be to lead by actually governing and not ideology. I think the biggest disappointment under Governor Walker is that some of the things we've seen in terms of conservative reforms in other states, on corrections, for instance, on reducing recidivism, simply haven't happened. In fact, he's neglected our system. We've got lawsuit problems up at Lincoln Hills, our other institutions, staffing issues. The second one would be infrastructure. I mean, whoever's governor of this state, Democrat, Republican, has always recognized the importance of a strong transportation infrastructure. In my part of the state, in Northeast Wisconsin, we make things. Getting those goods to market, in Chicago and other places safely and efficiently matters a lot.
If there had been a compromise package on transportation funding, highway funding, they would have raised the gas tax and or the registration fee. Would there have been Democratic votes for that, Representative?
There would have been Democratic votes for doing the right thing, to addressing the problem, to not punting. 4 years ago, 3 years ago, at the governor's holiday party, I mentioned I was going to be on finance. I said, Democrats want to work with you. If we have to separate transportation out of the budget, we're willing to. We think it's that important. We don't want the problem to get worse. We're interested in actually governing. We haven't seen that. I think the Assembly Republicans took some steps, but the reality is we're never going to fix transportation as long as Scott Walker's governor.
When you say you're going to gain seats in the next November election, how integral to those gains is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on redistricting? Are you banking on that?
I'm dealing with the world that we live in. Look, the reality is we think there are seats that we can pick up right now and be competitive. Democrats have won 33 legislative seats since Donald Trump was elected, many of them in red seats in red districts, both in Virginia and in Alabama and some other places. But obviously, the footprint expands. I do expect the Supreme Court to rule. I think there's a good chance it will find what the lower courts did, that our maps of having politicians pick their voters is unconstitutional, and that'll make things more competitive. I think there'll be more interest in Wisconsin. But again, the best thing that we have going for us, sort of like happened in Oklahoma recently, they said the best thing they've had going for us is 8 years of Republican majority rule, which has led to degradation of our environment, crumbling infrastructures, cuts to public education and the UW system, and really extreme policy on things like women's health. The public doesn't agree with those things, and we think that after 8 years, that message is going to resonate.
If the U.S. Supreme Court does toss out the current boundary lines, will you and Senator Schilling be there within hours with a new plan to offer the court, Representative?
Well, I think there's a lot of different outcomes. We were just having a discussion today about, what happens next if there is a ruling. I think some of it depends on what the instructions are. Will they send it down to the lower court to decide? Mm-hmm. Will they empower the majority to come back with new maps? Will there be a threshold that they have to abide by? Those things matter. Obviously, I'm someone who's been a proponent since I've been in office of independent redistricting that follows somewhat of the Iowa model. We could do other things. We could come together as Republicans and Democrats and try to, negotiate something. I think there are different things, but I think you're going to see more or hear more about what happens next should this decision happen, anytime now.
As the Assembly Democratic leader, you're out trying to find candidates. Have you begun the process, and are you finding more interest on the part of qualified and good Democratic candidates who might run in the next November election?
Yes.
And What are you telling them in terms of issues, how to organize, and how much to mention President Trump?
Well, I'm a huge believer in the diversity of the Democratic Party around the state, and I believe that members should reflect their districts. And that may mean there's some big tent of ideas. I don't want to employ a purity test, but I think Democrats are united around the values of opportunity, fairness, equality. I think we believe in public education. That's a big part of the opportunity piece. We're seeing more interest because the harsh lesson of 2016 was when people stay home, when we don't have candidates, when there's low turnout or lower turnout, these are the consequences. And I think people realize that we need more people to come forward. There's a lot of excitement. Obviously, people know that the districts they've announced or they're thinking about running in could change and might become more competitive. It is, you know, a smaller map with our existing maps, but we are seeing people put their names forward in districts that don't look very competitive. But they said the same thing in Virginia with a lot of seats where, you know, their strategy was run somebody in every seat, have the resources to compete, and, you know, I think they were hoping to win six, and they won more than 15.
Do you want to run somebody in every all 99?
We always try to run somebody. Candidate recruitment is, you know, it's mixed. The more you have to ask somebody to run, the more they usually are less they're willing to do things themselves. And so you hope that there's someone that is self-motivated for the right reasons. We try to work with those people about what their brand is, what they're interested in. But the first thing I usually tell candidates is go knock on some doors and just ask people what the issues are they're dealing with. You know, as a candidate, you don't get to make the issues. You don't get to decide what people should be interested in. And so that's what we've done with a number of our candidates that we think are going to be out there. And, you know, we would love to field 99. It's a good year, we think, for that. And hopefully there'll be 99 more competitive races.
2018 will be the second cycle with a totally new campaign finance code. Can you fund your candidates at least some amount of parity with the GOP?
Our candidates will have enough resources to be able to compete. Look, we're never going to be able to compete. We had a fundraiser in Janesville, you know, and the same night Republicans were raising money in Las Vegas at $6,000 a plate. They wrote the laws to benefit who they raised their money from. It's the same people that benefited from Donald Trump or Scott Walker's tax cuts. But, you know, look, part of working hard is being able to find the resources for our candidates to compete. We will get outspent. We know that. That's always been the case. But in assembly races, you can make that up in other ways. And I'm confident that we'll have the resources to compete.
What did you learn from the Attorney General's recent report on the John Does 1, 2, and 3, using his term?
I learned that the Attorney General is no J.B. Van Hollen or Jim Doyle or Peg Lautenschlager. You know, he seemed to take advantage of a very small part of the report to exercise some political things that he didn't like in the system. I think everybody has to remember that there was a criminal investigation here, that people were found guilty, that the governor had a criminal defense fund, that he had an illegal email server 5 feet away from his office. And this is a guy that knows everything about his campaigns. You know, maybe the public is confused by all this, but the fact that the small part of the report that was mentioned went after reporters, that went after the Chief Justice, that tried to confuse the public, that you know, they're trying to tarnish the reputations of civil servants who have done nothing but, you know, have the respect of both Republicans and Democrats at the Election and Ethics Board. And so I think it's a disgrace. I think he's demonstrating incompetence. And I think instead of him looking into investigations, maybe some others should maybe look into investigating him.
He's recommended contempt proceedings for 9 officials. Do you wish that would go away and that we could close the door on the whole John Doe saga in Wisconsin politics?
You know, to be honest with you, at this point, they're the ones that are keeping it out there. They ended this investigation early. We discovered that there were clear violations of what was existing campaign finance law when it comes to coordination. We know that that happened. It was illegal at the time. They've since changed the law. We know that people in some of the investigations, you know, there were criminal actions. You know, they ended it because they could. You know, they had the power, they had the control, they had the people in the courts to do so. This seems to be something different, some sort of sideshow to focus on this whole leaks thing. And to, you know, now we have the case where they've outed information that should have never been released. My guess is they might be more interested in putting it away right now than anybody else. But if they want to continue to trip over their own feet, I'm not going to get in the way.
Well, if Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald moves resolutions that terminates Michael Haass at elections and Brian Bell at ethics, does that give your party a major issue in the next election cycle, Representative?
You know, again, you know, to what extent the public is invested in this, you know, I'm not sure. But I'll say this, you know, Michael Haass and Mr. Bell have the support. There was just a 6-0 vote by the Republicans and the Democrats on the committee. These guys, I think, are trying to tarnish the reputations of these individuals, not because of anything that happened in the past, because I think they want someone that's more partisan in charge, that if there's a 3-3 vote, the governor can put his person in there to, you know, water down and control the administration of our elections. I have real concerns. What the public should be concerned about is why the majority leader and the speaker are trying to politicize the people that work with our clerks to have functioning elections in our state 10 months before the next election, at a time when we've got maybe international interference, where we've got cyber attacks on our system. I mean, the last thing that we need is to have this type of upheaval before such an important election. And my biggest fear is that the leaders on the Republican side are trying to set us up for something.
Your Fox Valley is the home of manufacturing in Wisconsin. Are industry leaders in the Fox Valley looking forward to participating in the supply side, to use the governor's term, in the Foxconn development, if Foxconn makes good on its development promises?
I mean, right now, business is doing pretty well. Obviously, they face the same labor shortage, and I would say that is some of their biggest concerns, is not being able to find the workers they need to meet their existing demand. Sure, are there some that hope that they can get an opportunity and maybe expand? Sure, but I would say the bigger concern is about the overall worker shortage that we face in Wisconsin, and maybe even what impact additional jobs taking people out of the Fox Valley might have down there. It has not been received very well. I mean, I've been to my chamber meetings where I've talked to small business people and said, you know, this is crazy. You can't buy sustainable economic development. There's never been an example of this kind of incentive package that's created an organic supply chain. I mean, the supply chain for these screens is going to be in China, because it's in China right now. The assembly of these products will take place at Foxconn if it ever happens.
I want to ask you the same question I asked Senator Schilling. If Foxconn has hired 300 to 500 people within a year, and if they've broken ground on a major facility, is your party at a disadvantage because most Democrats didn't vote for that incentive package?
No. And the reason is, the biggest opposition to the Foxconn project was the opportunity costs. Everybody has to remember, under the greatest case, the best case, if you hire all 13,000 people and there's 22,000 extra people and they invest $10 billion in this factory and we have automated lanes and everything, it will take 25 years to pay back. And if they hire 300 or 500 people and they don't make screens in 7 years, you know, I mean, the reality is, when I talked to UW System the other day, they said, well, you know, we're concerned when they're going to have to cut our budgets to pay for Foxconn in those ramp up years where the incentive give out is so high. And so, you know, our position wasn't that, yeah, look, I would love to have Foxconn here. But if you think, and now it's up to more than, I think it's $4.4 billion of residents of Wisconsin are paying, whether through roads, property taxes, utility charges. I mean, the fact that they're taking $134 million away from state highway projects to give to pay for local roads that support Foxconn, this is not a good deal. I mean, so many small businesses, new economy tech startups have said, you know, for a fraction of this, what you could do to grow new businesses, the new kind of businesses we know that are going to attract people here and that are going to create the type of jobs and opportunity we need, this is doubling down in the wrong direction.
You mentioned criminal justice reform. What would that look like? Question one. Question two, if you had reform, would there be no need to build a new state prison? Because there's a panel that's going to look at potentially building a new prison.
Yes. I mean, that's crazy that the fact that they're looking at, instead of managing the existing population or even reducing the existing population and having more people on probation or parole, especially for low-level technical violations or nonviolent offenses, they're talking, think about it, we have a flat population. We have the 15th oldest population in the country. We're going to have more retirees than we're going to have workers. And we've been pretty steady in the population that we have. And you're talking about building a new prison? Of all the things that we could do to make our state more desirable, to invest in opportunity, you're going to tell me that we're going to build a new prison? We can't even pay to fix our buildings on campuses? You know, we have schools going to referendum, and our biggest thing is going to expand our prison system? I mean, there's no other state that is heading in this direction, you know, especially Republican states.
So criminal justice changes under your proposal would, who would it potentially let out who's now in prison?
Well, I think we need to look at the number of people who are released from our institutions, who are out on probation or parole, that miss a report or miss something that they get resentenced or readmitted because of a technical violation. I think there are a number of other low-level offenses that you have to ask yourself, is the public any safer with this person off the streets? And what's the cost to society for spending more than $30,000 a year incarcerating someone? And so I think there are a number of different things that we can do, including changing our juvenile system. The problem with a lot of the changes to corrections is it's not going to happen overnight. You know, you can't just say, oh, we're going to let all these people out. But the fact that we've had 8 years under this governor, and I think one of his first bills was repealing the earned release program that Democrats passed in 2009 that allowed people serving in reward for good behavior and getting themselves prepared for transition, let them get out early for that, at least ones that had low-level offenses. And so, again, our job is to manage state taxpayers' dollars as effectively and efficiently as possible to fund the programs that provide the greatest opportunity in the state. The fact that these guys want to spend it locking people up, building a new prison, is incredible, and it's telling.
Your party has lost seats in rural Wisconsin. Why has it lost seats, and what are you going to do differently to reverse that trend?
Well, part of the challenge that we face as Democrats at the state level is that politics has increasingly been national. We see in polling that our candidates go up and down with what's happening at the national level. And, a lot of the things, we've lost a lot of young people in rural Wisconsin. We have less diversity out there. We know that the coalition of Obama voters that delivered the presidency was, high minority vote turnout, high single women turnout, and voters under 30. And of course, the distribution of those voters in the state hasn't been there as much. But some of it's because of the economic transformation, that's happened. And Democrats have a lot of good ideas about the future, but then you have a presidential candidate who says, I'm going to make America great. I'm going to bring us back to the 1950s. And, it's challenging because people will choose the past over the future. Look, we're going to try to compete everywhere. I don't believe in playing identity politics. I think you've got to have a broad message of opportunity, reminding people about the effectiveness over our America's history, about where government played that role in helping provide opportunity. We're going to take that message out there, but I am cognizant of the fact that we have a gubernatorial election and a U.S. Senate race, and that, the Trump-Walker agenda will be front and center.
Well, I just asked you about rural Wisconsin, so let me ask you about Milwaukee. Have the Republican policies of the past 7 years hurt Wisconsin's largest city, and if so, how?
They've hurt all of Wisconsin's cities. In fact, this is one of the things that I would say has hurt our millennial recruitment more than anything. If you look at where the innovation is happening in the country, it's happening at the local level. Washington was stuck in gridlock for years. Wisconsin's been in this sort of ideological drive, but whether it's public health or sustainability, quality of life initiatives, government public-private partnerships have increasingly happened at the local level, yet we've starved those communities of resources to be able to, they got to do the basics. They got to pick up garbage, they got to police, they got to fix the streets, although that's been harder. But a lot of the quality of life initiatives that we've seen other cities have to become dynamic. I mean, look, Milwaukee's got a lot of great things going for it, and it's a lot more affordable, but it hasn't been able to do some of the things that states that have actual partners supporting those communities has been able to do. I think we really need to push back against this adverse, hostile relationship that has usurped local control and has drained our communities of the resources to be able to enhance the quality of life with some of their homegrown decision making.
You represent the UW-Oshkosh. Is it a wise decision to merge the two-year colleges with the 4 years like Oshkosh?
To be honest with you, I had more questions about how it was handled than I do about the actual proposal. My chancellor came from Georgia, where they had done this years earlier, and he had been involved in it. In Oshkosh's case, you could say you can imagine it. You know, UW Fond du Lac and UW Fox are both within, I think, 20 miles of the campus. There's already a lot of regional commuters there. I think in some parts of the state, there's an identity issue. We went up to finance a few years ago up in Rice Lake with UW Barron County. I know what that meant to that school, and it's quite a ways from Eau Claire. We're faced with declining enrollment, and I would prefer that we spend fewer dollars on administration and more dollars in the classroom. And so we all have to be realistic about this, but we also know the two-year schools have a different mission. I mean, they were there to be very affordable, to help people get through their first 2 years without taking on tons of debt. And of course, the counties own the schools. And so, I am open to it. I think it's got to be handled right, and there has to be some assurances that this just isn't going to be a push to close what is really important in so many communities in terms of reaching people that are trying to better themselves.
The Democratic wins in the U.S. Senate and governorship in Alabama, Virginia, New Jersey. Is that translatable to the local EG state assembly level?
When people get very excited about it, I'm excited. I'm feeling the excitement here about the opportunity, but it isn't apples to apples. Virginia has a 20% minority population. Alabama, I think, was 29. Wisconsin, the African American population is about 6, and the distribution isn't as wide. We also have a lot of older voters. We have voters with lower educational attainment, things that correlate with outcomes. That being said, I don't think anybody who's a resident of Wisconsin believes that we've ever moved as far publicly as the governing that we've had. And it's increasingly challenging because of the lack of media. You know, my newspaper has no local editorial content. They have a handful of reporters. Social media, talk radio, other things have dominated. And, of course, national news gets covered, but state and local news are decreasingly, not around. And so we've had to work harder to try to get out not just the 6 weeks before the election, but during the two-year period so people recognize, what's been happening and what needs to change.
Just two more questions. Prior to becoming leader, you were on Joint Finance. What shape is the 1921 budget in when you've promised incentives to Foxconn and other tax breaks, and we're using $48 million to pay lottery prizes? What shape is the next budget in, Representative?
I think the next budget's in shaky shape, and let me tell you why. We are in the second longest economic expansion in U.S. history. So as long as our country has been around, this is the second longest period. And the national economy is growing. Wisconsin's is growing a little bit more than half of what the national economy is. And think about it, we've cut more than $800 million during this second longest economic expansion. We've gutted schools and then increased some funding to restore those cuts during the second longest economic expansion. We haven't invested in things that could be on a sustainable path. We haven't put money away in a way that's going to address any kind of downturn. And you know what's going to happen at some point. I mean, the question for voters in Wisconsin is, are we in a better place now than we were 8 years ago? Is this a more desirable place? And has this governor used the second longest economic expansion to make the kind of transformative investments that our people need to be able to succeed in this kind of new economy? And I think the answer is overwhelmingly no.
Then the final question. Your caucus had a closed session on Representative Zebnick. He was asked to leave. Does he have a decision to make? Has he made it?
We leadership in our caucus, acted. We asked them to, resign. We've acted to take committees away, to take staff away. I'm not going to go into what happens in closed caucus, but obviously, we'll see what happens going forward.
Assembly Democratic Leader Gordon Hintz, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.